So I'm walking back up to our storefront, which I haven't been to in many months.
Last year, we, the Marketplace Wealth and Poverty team, rented a little storefront in a working-class neighborhood in Los Angeles called Highland Park. We wanted to get a street's-eye view of the changing local economy, what some call gentrification. Our storefront was on a modest corner at the intersection of York Boulevard and Figueroa Street, just down from a discount furniture store and an appliance repair shop. I went back recently to see what our place had become after we moved out.
And what is here? Looks like it is a high-end clothing boutique.
Like, really high-end.
A tank top that was originally $470 and has been reduced twice to now a low, low price of $235. That's funny.
Welcome to the second ever podcast from Marketplace's Wealth and Poverty team. I'm Chrissy Clark, one of the reporters on the team.
And I'm Caitlin Esch, a producer. And this week, we're revisiting some of the people and places we profiled last year to see where they are now. It's an update on our project, York and Fig, which was an investigation of the forces driving gentrification in Highland Park.
And other neighborhoods around the country that are in similar moments of change. This month is an anniversary of sorts. We first moved into the neighborhood a full year ago.
And by the way, you can listen to the first podcast at marketplace.org/YorkAndFig.
That's slash, not backslash, which we learned
last
week from our listeners. But now back to our former storefront.
As you just heard Chrissy discover, it's now a high-end clothing shop called Nona, and we had to stop by.
Nona means grandmother in Italian. My name is Olivia, and I own this store, Nona.
That's Olivia Perez. She's a former costume designer, and she says her shop carries high-end boutique lines with a cult-like following.
And I grew up in Miami, Florida in the 80s, so if you come in here, I feel like it kind of has a little bit of a Golden Girls vibe slash Nona vibe, which is, I don't know, I'd like to think that it's cozy, bright, and comfortable.
Nona opened just a few months ago, and it kind of stands out in this still mostly low and moderate income Latino neighborhood.
As evidenced by the markdown $235 tank top in the window.
The 50% off sales.
Olivia is aware of this contradiction. She knows her store is expensive in the context of Highland Park.
I don't expect anyone to spend their whole paycheck on one thing, you know. I mean, I'm happy to have people just try stuff on.
So there's not a ton of foot traffic in the store yet, but Olivia does most of her business online anyway.
And why did she pick this location on the corner of York Boulevard and Figueroa Street?
Well, Olivia says she was drawn to this corner because the building was move-in ready, rent is cheap, the light is good, and she likes being close to where she lives just a few miles away.
Not because she wanted to be in the place that the Marketplace Bureau once had been.
Actually, she didn't even know that we had been there until she'd already decided to move in.
That makes perfect sense. But Olivia's arrival in this neighborhood is an interesting indicator of how the neighborhood is changing, because it's in this sort of transition point right now where there are still some places where you can find cheap rent. It's like, what, $800 a month, I think?
$900,
which isn't too bad for the rest of Los Angeles. But there are also enough people in this area now who have money to spend. And there are enough of them that you can open a high-end boutique and think it might have a chance.
Some of the most, you know, fulfilling months I've had in a couple of years have been just like me sitting at my desk, just seeing who like wanders in the store and what cool character, neighborhood character am I going to talk to next.
Like the guy who came in one day and read her palm.
people who, I think a lot of people just want to talk, you know? A lot of people have been living in the neighborhood for some of them their whole lives and are just curious, you know? They've probably seen this space go through so many different lives.
It's true. Olivia's storefront has seen many different lives, many different tenants over the years. And the story of this building tells this larger story of how this neighborhood is changing, which helps tell the even larger story about how our economy is changing all around the country.
And you can actually peel back the wallpaper, so to speak, and trace the history back decades.
So, for example, before Olivia's high-end clothing shop, we were there documenting changes in the neighborhood.
Olivia's dressing room is actually in this little alcove where we had built our resident recording booth.
And before we were there, for many years through the 90s and 2000s, it was the office for a bilingual Spanish-English tax preparer. He retired recently, but he had helped lots of low-income immigrant families file their taxes.
And before that, in the 1980s, this sign maker, Jose Valdivia, he had a workshop in our old bureau. He was born in Mexico, but he grew up in Highland Park. And he says he used to make signs for the neighborhood restaurants, and he had a whole advertising philosophy.
You only need one letter, one word that will explain the whole thing. Like a lot of Mexicans, they basically put a whole menu in front of the business. If you have one letter that explains everything, fine Mexican food, boom, that's it. But they put the burrito, the carne de boca.
Jose still lives in the neighborhood today in his mother's converted garage. We asked him how he feels about the way his neighborhood is changing as wealthier people, often young creative professionals, come in.
I was talking to a young white guy also working for the movie industry. And he asked me the same question. You guys don't like us moving in here? And I said, no, it's not that we don't like it. It's that everything's going up, you know. All the rents are going up. I used to pay for this $350 a month.
$350 a month for this storefront back then, which is almost $1,000 a month now. That's a big jump even with inflation. But going even further back in the time capsule that is this building to the 1940s and 50s, this building was home to a young boy named Stephen Simon. He's a retired philosophy professor now. But back then, the apartment upstairs was actually where Stephen's parents brought him after he was born in 1942.
My parents actually were given 2 free years of rent in 61, 89 and a half above us, because my father's parents owned this brownstone building.
Stephen eventually inherited the building. He still owns it. In fact, he was our landlord.
His grandfather bought it in the early 1900s after emigrating from Lebanon. Stephen remembers Highland Park as a neighborhood of immigrants even back then, though mostly from Eastern Europe.
I remember, and my father really remembers, that there was a huge mixture of people, Italians, Bulgarians, Greeks, Lebanese, Syrians, Palestinians. All of these people were here, and they were craftsmen, and they made furniture, or they did crafty kinds of things.
The neighborhood has obviously changed a lot since then, no surprise. Stephen remembers the old streetcars that connected Highland Park to downtown back then.
It was connected with Los Angeles by this sort of umbilical cord.
clickety, 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 clickety,
all the time, back and forth. And then directly across the street from here, there was nothing like there is right now. There was a kind of locally famous chili joint called Chilivilles.
That's where Stephen says he'd take high school dates to hang out and enjoy some chili.
So you can peel back the wallpaper on this building, but on old buildings all over Highland Park. And in doing so, tell this larger story of a neighborhood and of an economy. Of course, it wasn't too hard to find out what happened to our building over the years and track down the old tenants, because the same family, Stephen Simon's family, has owned it for almost a century now. But right now, the neighborhood is in flux. Buildings are changing hands really fast, and as people move on, their stories can get easily lost. In fact, when you talk to economists and sociologists who research gentrification, they all tell you that one of the hardest things is to find out what happens to people who get displaced when a neighborhood changes really fast and rents start going up.
Right, because once you start asking around, it's often too late. Those people have already disappeared.
Right, you can't find them. But because we've been in this neighborhood for so many months, right in this pivotal moment of change, we've been able to meet people who were here when we first got here and have since left. And so we have these rare stories of where they've gone.
Which brings us to this one particular building in Highland Park with a super interesting history. It's just a few blocks away from our storefront.
It's this crumbling brick place. For years and years and years, it was a residential hotel for low-income men on the top floor. And then on the bottom floor, it was a swap mall. Mom-and-pop vendors sold discounted goods there. When we first ran across this building back in 2014, it was through the eyes of a real estate agent who, like many of her colleagues, was peering through the windows imagining what it could be.
This could be broken up into like two or three little cute boutiques, and that's probably going to happen soon.
So what did ever happen? Before I get to what happened to the building itself, let me first tell you a little bit more about the people inside it. Because there was way more to this building than what you could see when you peered in through the dusty windows or read the real estate brochure about it being a prime mixed-use opportunity. This building was filled with history and stories and all these characters.
Okay, I have to mention this guy. That was Crazy Ralph.
Crazy
Ralph. And then you got Crazy Tony out there, and right in the room right across from me, Rodney, the Kool-Aid guy. They always drank Kool-Aid, you know.
John Piper, the guy rattling off that list, he was also a resident of this building for almost a decade. Also a character. He's a former welder, former Air Force guy, former heavy metal drummer at the Excalibur in Las Vegas.
Came this close to being famous, you know, more or less, you know, but it just didn't quite happen.
John is in his 50s, disabled, lost most of the movement in his right hand after he collapsed during a pulmonary embolism. That was around the time he moved into this building.
It's such a good place to live for guys. And we can't help but like the place, you know. I mean, we got good rent, all utilities paid. I mean, I was able to open my window, look out right there on Figueroa. I could watch the parades. I could see them out the window and watch Santa Claus go by. What's not to really like about that?
There were definitely some things not to like about the place, though, John says. It was where people without a lot of other options came to live. There was an only half-joking joke around the building that once you moved in,
you leave in a bag.
During the years that John lived there, he says, one resident died of a gunshot wound, another guy hanged himself, another died of lung cancer. But John says there was also this accidental, if slightly chaotic, community that formed among people on the edge who looked out for each other. He used to take one of his neighbors, who had a brain injury, to a food pantry at a local church once a month.
Way back when I first moved in there, and I was broke and trying to figure out how I was going to eat, you know. Him and I used to make sure that we'd circle that date on the calendar, and we'd go down there and get groceries on that Thursday, you know what I mean? Because he needed somebody to help him out, you know.
Sometimes all the tenants would have barbecues on the roof together, watch fireworks on the 4th of July.
Hello. Hi. How are you guys?
Good, and you?
I'm good.
I first visited this building last fall, around the time that realtor was scoping it out for a couple of potential cute boutiques. A bunch of the tenants, including John Piper, were shooting the breeze downstairs. I asked them if I could pick their brain about the building.
He's the only one with a brain.
Yeah,
I got
a few jobs coming in tomorrow.
If you pick ours, you'll get like trash and empty beer cans.
They told me the attention the building was getting was not lost on them. What might happen if the place got sold was actually a big topic of conversation. Carlos Valdez, who ran a little computer repair shop in the building, argued that a new owner could mean upgrades to the building, and that would be good for his business.
If you had landlords that would care about their building and go, hey, look, we got to improve for our tenants, I'm pro for it.
At this point, another guy, one of the other residential hotel tenants, Frank Valenzuela, interrupted. He said, no way. If this building gets bought,
you know, everyone would get evicted and the building would be refurbished into something else. Whoever buys it is just going to want to, okay, all the tenants out. Then we decide what's the best thing to do with it that's going to earn us back our investment. And then they're going to go with that. And I really doubt it's renting little rooms to crazy people. Never mind.
John Piper, the disabled drummer, was listening to them debate all this. And I asked him,
so if they sold the building, what would happen to you?
I'd probably go live with my brother's house in Redondo Beach or something. Probably be good for me.
That was almost a year ago. Since then, the building has been sold for $3.6 million. And John Piper did not end up in Redondo Beach.
How you doing on this hot day?
Oh my gosh, it is a hot day.
Instead, he ended up in Van Nuys, another working-class neighborhood on the outskirts of Los Angeles, in this two-bedroom apartment that he shares with two other people.
And my room's a wreck still.
That's what happens when you move.
Yeah, I still haven't tried to figure out where to put everything, you know, is the story of that. You know?
He pays $100 more than the unit he had to himself in Highland Park. It's the cheapest thing he could find. The last few months have been a scramble, John tells me. He found out his old apartment building had been sold back in February, right after his birthday. That's when the building manager and the new property manager met with him. He says they told him the new owners were planning on renovating the building, probably turning it into an office building.
And everybody's going to need to move. I said, really? Everybody? Me and everybody that lives up here and, like, this whole swap mall and everybody, you mean? He goes, yeah. And I was like, wow. That really sucks.
Even if, in theory, John had thought, someday I probably should get out of that place. I don't want to leave in a bag. When the reality hit him that he had to move out, he says it felt like a big wave crashing on him.
I'm tumbling around on the bottom of the ocean, you know, hitting the bottom in the sand and the coral, and before I could get up out of the water, you know, again, you know. That's kind of what the whole thing felt like.
When he finally found this new apartment in Van Nuys...
I didn't really want to move all the way out here.
It's about a 45-minute drive from his old neighborhood, which John says can feel isolating.
That's where I had all my connections and everything was right there, you know, in Highland Park. And I kind of miss living over there because it's... Now, for me to do anything, I got to go drive all the way back over there, you know, and that's... And this traffic out here, coming out here and back and forth is just... Oh, God.
The silver lining, he says, is he got some money from the building owners, and he used some of it to buy a car, which he needs now since his new place is so far away. The money came out of a series of negotiations with the new owners, John says.
They said, you have to move, and here's $8,000. And I said, no, thank you. So then they raised it to 10. And I said, nope, sorry. That's not the law. And I'm a true blue person, okay? I know what I'm entitled to. I've looked it up. I've found out. I know I got all the proof I need that if I had to go to court, this is the amount of money that I will get.
The amount John had in his head was a little over $19,000. That's how much a disabled person who's lived in a unit for more than 3 years is entitled to under Los Angeles rent control laws. John figured rather than fight for that money in court and have to hire a lawyer, he'd settle for less. He got $14,000. Between all the moving costs and staying in a hotel while he found the new, more expensive place and buying a car, most of the money's already gone.
The money definitely helped, you know, and it got me, has gotten me to a point to where I'm okay now. But look what it's taken me. Now I'm down to $1,500 now, you know.
But there's something that John did not know. Residential hotel units like the one he lived in have special protections in L.A. Landlords have to get city approval in order to convert them into an office building or anything else. Approvals his new property owners had not applied for yet. And in fact, John didn't have to leave his apartment at all. He could have told the owners he wanted to stay. I told this to John.
Did you know that?
No. Yeah, but they would have raised our rent astronomically.
I don't think they could, because it was rent controlled.
Yeah, because it was rent controlled. Yeah, I never even knew that they said I could have stayed. They never even mentioned it.
Tenants, they often don't know their rights.
Rafael Bostic is a housing expert and professor of public policy at USC. He says these kinds of negotiations happen all the time.
Most of these folks are not skilled, seasoned negotiators, whereas the developer is going to have a team of folks who this is what they do. So there definitely is the possibility for the tenant. I don't want to say be taken advantage of because it's not really what it is, but for a tenant to agree to a worse deal than they might have otherwise been able to get.
I tracked down the new owner of the building. Tom Myich. He owns a real estate investment and development company in Los Angeles. He says he wasn't involved himself in the negotiation with John Piper. But in general, he says it's up to tenants to know their own rights.
I'm not, you know, and this is like a derogatory word, but like I'm not their babysitter and I'm not their parent.
Tom says some of the residential hotel tenants didn't pay rent or were using or dealing drugs on the property. He told me he paid tenants to leave the property because he cares about the neighborhood. He wanted to clean it up.
Can I support everyone's challenge? Absolutely not, and I never can. But I very much care about this part of town. And it's because I care that we, you know, we made the investment so that it isn't an area where people are overdosing in our driveway, which happened. Like, we're going to prevent that.
Do you know where folks went, the people who did move out?
I know where one went. One went to Highland Park with his sister somewhere. But other than that one, I don't.
Do you wonder?
I don't.
Here's as complete a list as I could come up with of where people did end up. One guy moved in with his mom and used the buyout money he got to start school as a medical technician. Another took the money and bought a house out by the Salton Sea. And another is actually working for the new building owners. And of course, John Piper, the ex-drummer, lives with a bunch of roommates far away from his old stomping grounds in Highland Park.
I'm not as happy as I was there, but my life is okay. But I'm not as happy as I was. Everything worked for me where I was right there, you know? And this has just upset my whole entire life, you know?
As for Crazy Ralph and Crazy Tony and all the other guys, John says he doesn't know. But when I walked through the halls of the building a few weeks ago with the new owner, as workers were clearing out all the units, I saw something.
What's this?
I have no idea. Notes left from tenants. You see that a lot.
There were little green post-it notes that someone had stuck on the doors to some of the rooms with names of old tenants and the letters RIP, rest in peace. I'm Chrissy Clark for Marketplace.
That's it for our podcast today. We're busy working on a few more podcast episodes for this series. They'll be popping up in the next few weeks. Stay tuned for stories about how longtime business owners in gentrifying neighborhoods all around the country are adjusting to the changes and finding really interesting ways to try to hang on in their communities using everything from the ballot box to satirical advertising campaigns.
One story involves a guy we heard from briefly in this episode, Carlos Valdez, the guy who owned the computer repair shop in the building with the residential hotel on top. He's become a reluctant poster child for displacement in Highland Park. The apartment his family had lived in for more than 20 years was sold, and the building where he ran his business.
So I was like, really? Like, I just lost my house, now you're telling me I'm going to lose my business?
But Carlos says he's staying put.
I'm Highland Park for life. You know, I was born and raised, so I'm not going anywhere. This is my neighborhood. You know, I have friends telling me, look, move somewhere else. And I go, no, why am I going to move? Why? Because they're challenging how much I can make. Hey, tell me I got to make $1,000 tomorrow. I'll do it.
More about Carlos's plan on the next episode.
Our York and Fig podcasts are produced by me, Caitlin Esch. Daniel Ramirez is the engineer.
Nancy Fargali is the senior editor. Deborah Clark is the vice president and executive producer of Marketplace. And I'm Chrissy Clark.
Oh, hey, and if you like this, help us do more by giving us a super glowing review on iTunes.
This is APM.